I need your help this morning. When I grew up in a church that would respond during preaching, and our pastor used to say, I would never want to be in one of those churches where when somebody yelled out, Amen, the preacher stopped and said, What did you say? I often chuckle that I now belong to that kind of tradition. And I went to a church and somebody shouted out, oh, amen, and it shocked me, so I stopped. I want to ask that you respond this morning, and I'm going to point to this section. If I point to this section, I'd like you to say, amen.
Amen.
And if I point to this section, I want you to say, yes. But punch it. Yes.
Yes.
That's it. And the choir and the clergy, if I point to you, I'd like you to say, well.
Well.
No? Well.
Well.
It's more speculative. Well. Yeah, there we go. Maybe we should pray again. The designated reading for today has always been a personal favorite. The Lord does indeed have more light and truth to break forth from God's holy word. And therefore, in reading this text again, I saw a few new things I hadn't noticed before. Pam read the lesson so well. I believe Luke still has an urgent and critical message for us to hear today about what it means to be Easter people in a Good Friday world. It seems entirely fitting that we look at some of the new facets of Luke's message as we honor Old South member Phyllis Wheatley, who was born May 8, 1753, in West Africa. She was kidnapped at age 7, brought to this country, sold at an auction as a slave. She was auctioned in what is today Chinatown. You can see it on the Boston Women's Heritage Trail, right there at Beach and Tyler Streets. And there's a plaque there to commemorate that event. She was named Phyllis after the slave ship, which is why it's spelled so unusually. She carried the last name Wheatley, the name of her owners. Her owners were benevolent and educated her well. She died in 1784 at the age of 31. Poor, having lost 2 children to sickness, gotten through part of an abusive relationship with a man who ultimately left them. And despite her gifts, she found it difficult to support her family by publishing her works, which mostly sold in London and not in America. After the Revolutionary War, it became very difficult for her to sell her work as an American in London. Sadly, some things haven't changed enough. Women, people of color, the poor, I'm afraid, still find it difficult to support families. I'm amazed how many of us still live without a living wage. We owe a debt of gratitude this morning to Eric Gustafson, who gave wings to this young woman's words in an anthem which you will hear. It says, from thee, O man, what gratitude should rise, and when from balmy sleep thou op'st thine eyes, let thy first thoughts be praises to the skies. How merciful our God, who thus imparts o'erflowing joy to human hearts, After such a life, she could write those words. Today's gospel lesson springs from Luke's closing chapter and falls on the heels of his Easter narrative. Luke's gospel begins telling us that he's writing an orderly account of the things that happened in the life and death and ministry of Jesus. He tells the stories also toward the end of his followers' unfulfilled hope, of their mysterious reappearances of Jesus in human yet superhuman form, it seemed, all suggesting there will indeed be a sequel. This morning, I'd like us to focus on just a narrow piece of Jesus' engagement with women from those two bookends in the Gospel of Luke. As we look at the subject, I've got a name. Luke's opening chapter wastes no time getting down to the miraculous story of John the Baptist's birth, the one who would prepare the way for Jesus. And when the angel Gabriel appeared, announcing John's birth, his father, a priest named Zechariah, had such disbelief that the angel made him unable to speak until after the child was born. Of course, Zechariah was 92 years old. I assume he was just shocked. Perhaps his not being able to speak was a mixed blessing. Can you imagine what they said at the barbershop? Luke's first chapter, we're told that the angel Gabriel also had an announcement to Mary about 6 months later, that she too would have a son. Unlike Zechariah, Mary didn't question the angel. Instead, Mary gives us the Magnificat, which we all memorized because of Quinn. He's going to give you a test next week. She prophesied the greatness of the child she would bear and the ways God's kingdom would come closer, all because of Jesus. Amen. Let's fast forward to the last chapter of Luke, where we see two additional situations. The first is the resurrection story in which the women, Mary Magdalene, Joanna, and Mary, the mother of James, and a few other women, come to the tomb to care for Jesus' body in the tradition of Jewish practice. When they get to the tomb, they see messengers or angels who tell them that Jesus has been raised and is alive, just as he said. The women ran back to tell the 11 disciples, along with other followers. And guess what the disciple boys said? I'm sorry. They said that the stories of the women seemed like an idle tale and that they did not believe them. Now, the third story involves a woman from that last chapter in Luke. You heard it read this morning, but you might ask, I don't remember hearing anything about a woman. Well, the other night, as I was half awake, half asleep, it seemed, maybe dreaming, that I heard the phone ring, and I answered the phone, and on the other end of the phone was a woman who said to me, "Ron, I'm the unnamed person that was on the road to Emmaus with Cleopas, the one that Luke didn't see fit to name. It's nothing new," she said. "In my time, they felt no need to mention the names of women or children. But most people hearing this story in my time would have assumed that I was a woman and that my name was just not mentioned because it wasn't important. She said, but quite frankly, Ron, I'm getting tired of not being named. You see, honey, I've got a name. She continued, when Saul was on the Damascus Road and had a vision of Jesus, they changed his name to Paul and called him an apostle. But me, they don't even mention my name. I've got a name. She continued, of course, there's one benefit to me not being named, and that is that whenever I encounter other women who have a similar fate of not being named, I can take their identity and stand for them. If you want, you can change my name this morning. You can call me Phyllis Wheatley, one of the millions of female variations on my same story. It's hard to believe that no one would believe that she wrote those poems because she was a woman and because she was black. I listened and I thought, you know, even Thomas Jefferson had the audacity to believe that black people did not have that capability as he entered this debate. And we know that Thomas Jefferson should have known better. Especially with all the little Jeffersons running around Virginia. But to prove this assumption false, an assembled group of leaders, including the governor, the lieutenant governor, Cotton Mather, and others, grilled Phyllis Wheatley for an entire day to prove that she had the knowledge to write the poems. At the end of the day, they walked away with the discovery that a black woman could do such things. It was indeed for them a discovery like electricity. No one had ever considered that a black person could do these things, let alone a woman. It was such news that she was the talk of London. She went to meet with the Queen. She saw Ben Franklin while she was over there. All of the European literati wanted to meet with her. But when she returned to America from Europe, she was just another slave. Can't you hear her cry out this morning? I've got a name. Poet is my name. The woman on the phone went on. She said, you could call me Antoinette Brown, the first woman ordained in Christendom in 1853 in your denomination. Brown wrote to a friend that people are starting to take it seriously. At first they were laughing, but they're starting to get mad now that they know that a church in upstate New York really did ordain a woman. They did what? They ordained a woman. But Antoinette Brown said, I've got a name. Ordained preacher of the good news to all people. Perhaps you could call me Mother Teresa, of whom John Paul himself was an avid supporter, fluent in five languages, established ongoing help for thousands among the poor, the homeless, the hungry. And in past few weeks, passed over for beatification. I think I heard her say, okay, boys, I've got a name. Feeder of the hungry. Healer of the sick. Clother of the naked. As I listened to her, I remembered a cartoon sent to me in my email by a dear friend who's here this morning. She sent me an interesting cartoon of a young man sitting on a park bench with Jesus and asking him, "So, Jesus, why do you allow things like famine, war, suffering, crime, despair, etc.?" Jesus turns and looks at the young man. He says, "Funny you should bring that up. I was about to ask you the same question. You see, we have a name. We are creators with God of change in this world. When I hung up the phone, perhaps dreaming, perhaps awake, it seems I could hear Jesus say to me, 'Tell my people, remind them you've got a name. When you feel depressed and hopeless, when hope seems gone as those travelers on the Emmaus Road, remember you have a name. We are people of unrelenting hope.'" When people ask how our denomination, the United Church of Christ, could sue the state of North Carolina for robbing North Carolina clergy of their religious freedom to marry same gender-loving couples, tell them we've got a name, a people of courage in the struggle for justice and peace for all the people, not just some. No matter who they are or where they are on life's journey. As I close, I want to say this. Many people mistakenly thought "God is Still Speaking" was just an ad campaign, or that it was about God talking. But I'm writing about that now, and I just want you to know that it was always about the fact that when God said, "Let there be," at creation, and worlds came into existence, that God is still speaking, still creating something from nothing. And the people of God, like you and me, are still traveling on those Emmaus Road journeys after disappointments, feeling discouraged in our hearts. But Jesus is still appearing in our midst, and our eyes are becoming opened, and we see Jesus in our midst, and we see that we have a name as partners with God in helping to finish God's ongoing creation. God speaks through our hands, through our minds, through our hearts, until the kingdom of this world becomes the kingdom of our God. Until God looks at us in all those things that are still unfinished and says, "That's good. I've got a name. You've got a name." Yes. Hear God calling this morning. If you aren't hearing it yet, I ask you to bow your head. And together, let us keep listening. When you hear the call of God, I invite you to listen, to answer. across this room, in the quiet of this moment, with the utterings of a child. God is still speaking, my friends. How will we answer? Amen.